This is KOWS 107.3 FM, Occidental, California. From Berkeley, California, I think we have Zenobia Barlow. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
We are in Berkeley, aren't we?
Well, I'm actually in Oakland today, but
okay.
Close by. I work in Berkeley.
All right. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I must say, I've heard your name. I've seen your name in print for a long, long time, and I never zeroed in on you to any degree, I must say, until recently, and I'm aware that you are a woman of stature, that you've been working on behalf of us human types, of the human community and the human family, for a while now, haven't you?
That is correct. Well, for all living beings.
Yes, yes, ma'am. Absolutely. Zenobia Barlow, among many, many other things, is the co-founder and director of the Center for Eco-Literacy, Schooling for Sustainability. And I will invite you in just a few seconds to sketch in the history, the origin of the Center for Eco-Literacy. And let me just say that there is a book that is newly in our hands called Eco-Literate, which is co-written or co-composed by Daniel Goleman and Lisa Bennett and Ms. Barlow. And it's subtitled How Educators Are Cultivating Emotional, Social, and Ecological Intelligence. And it's certainly a book whose time has come and a movement whose time has come. And we welcome you heartily to our little humble little radio show.
Oh, thank you very much. And I love Occidental, so it's my great pleasure to be with you.
Well, excellent. Next time you're in town, we'll buy you a beer.
Oh, that's great.
Good. Excellent. Okay, the Center for Eco-Literacy. You know what? Hold on a second with that. Would you please sketch in for us to the degree that you feel comfortable, the general outlines of your career?
Oh, God. Well, let's see. I used to work at Sonoma State, so I know Occidental well. I was the director of, extended education. I ran all the programs that had to generate their own funding, and summer school and external degree programs and that kind of thing. So I spent a few years there. I worked for the government. I was the regional director of education and training for the Office of Child Development in the federal regional office in San Francisco. And enjoyed a joint appointment with the American Academy of Pediatrics. So that territory was vast and included the territories of the South Pacific, Hawaii, California, Nevada, and Arizona. I lived in Hong Kong and was the executive editor of a publishing company. And then I came
How long were you in Hong Kong?
Let's see, from 85 through 89.
Oh.
I left at Tiananmen Square. And we did beautiful color photo books on Asian themes, so I got to spend a lot of time flying in and out of Hong Kong to lots of places.
Hong Kong's a great city, isn't it?
Well, it's the heartbeat is the sound of pile drivers. It's a very lively place, and I lived in central Hong Kong, near the harbor, and it's a vibrant, thriving, crazy place.
Okay. So, picking up where I interrupted you?
Well, when I left Hong Kong, I came back to the United States, and I had known Fritjof Capra previously. I had organized a conference on intuition, and Fritjof was great because they were the people who were, very literal and the people who were very psychic, I guess, or intuitive. And Fritjof was a wonderful listener. And on day three, he started the day by very carefully summarizing what the various camps had, how they'd positioned themselves, and finding some kind of synthesis and way through the contradictions. So I had gotten to know him, and I liked him very much. And when I came back to the United States, I saw that his ecological think tank was in search of an executive director. So for some reason, I thought, oh, that would be the perfect thing to do. So I applied and was appointed, and that's how I came to direct a project called the Eco Literacy Project that was a project of this ecological think tank, and out of it grew the creation of the Center for Eco Literacy. So on January 1 of 1995, Fritjof Capra and Peter Buckley, who had been the generous benefactor and also one of the progenitors of the Ecological Literacy Project, and I created the Center for Eco Literacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations, and we're glad you did.
Thank you. It's been quite an adventure.
And we're just going to quickly acknowledge Daniel Goldman and Lisa Bennett, and is it Carolee or Carolee Sly?
Carolee Sly, our Director of Education Programs.
Yes, yes. Maybe just a word or two about these folks.
Okay. Well, when we started the Center for Eco Literacy in 1995, Dan Goldman's sort of worldwide, phenomenally best-selling book, Emotional Intelligence, was published. And he went on subsequently to publish Social Intelligence and many books on leadership. But Emotional Intelligence, which posited that probably the greatest indicator in one's success in life was really one's emotional intelligence. And it sort of was a paradigm shifter. And millions of people, literally millions of people all over the world, I think, I've forgotten how many were sold in China alone, but it was a popular, very bestseller, and it was on the best-selling list in the New York Times for, I think, something like 2 years. So it permeated education, and many educators with whom we were working to design what we thought ecological literacy would look like in schools were very interested in emotional and social intelligence. So from the beginning of our work, we were really immersed in the work of Daniel Goldman. So that's Dan, and then Dan went on to write Ecological Intelligence, which was published, I think, 3 years ago. And so we picked up our relationship with Dan again. He's known lots of people in our network of people, and expressed our interest, and he came to see us, and he was the first person we met with in our new offices in the David Brower Center 3 years ago. And so we got into really exciting, engaging conversations that continued, and then we decided to write a book together. And so the second person, our co-author, is Lisa Bennett, and Lisa is the communications director at the Center for Eco Literacy. So Dan and Lisa and I had lots of exciting conversations with Carolee Sly, who is our director of education programs and a very accomplished science educator and someone who's published a lot of curricula, and she's really an expert facilitator of professional development. So the four of us really came together, and Lisa is a very accomplished and eloquent writer, and she researched lots of stories that appear in the book. And so anyway, the four of us somehow managed to create a book which is both interesting and engaging and provides a professional development strategy for educators to use in schools across the country.
And it's getting out there?
It seems to be getting out there, yeah. People are coming at it from lots of different points of view, and we got lots of people who I think you've interviewed. I saw that your list of interviewees is an impressive group of people, and many of them wrote glowing recommendations for the book. So yeah, it's getting a lot of attention and selling well, I'm pleased to say.
Well, it's a wonderful book. I've been enriched by it, and just a couple of quick words about Wendy Williams, and we'll get into the book.
Okay.
I don't know. Yes, from you, please.
Oh, okay.
Wendy Williams.
And I wanted to ask you what it was about the book that attracted you.
It's the terrible, terrible urgency.
Uh-huh.
The lassitude of our the way we just walk through these years of such momentous consequence. I've long been frustrated at the kind of the pokey pace of embracing the critical reality of these years. And the book is an intervention. It's a direct intervention into, I think, a sclerotic public education system. It's a presentation of it replaces decades of habit and institutional lethargy, if you don't mind, with something that is awake and aware and alive, and threatens to treat our children with greater respect for their intelligence, and to introduce them to the world that they needn't wait any longer to be engaged with.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you. I'll pick up responding to some of the points that you made after I answered the question you asked me, which was, who is Wendy Williams? Let's see. While we were thinking about creating the Center for Eco-Literacy, or we were in the process of creating the Center for Eco-Literacy, Fritjof Capra was interviewed on the radio. Maybe you were the person who interviewed him. And so the interview played over and over on some public radio station. And someone heard it, and that person was Wendy Williams. And so she tried to find the Center for Eco-Literacy. And I think we had just gotten a telephone number under that listing. And I was sitting in a brand new little office that we had built. And I remember that I didn't have a chair yet, and I was sitting on the stairwell, and the phone rang. I think we were going to open the following week, and it was Wendy Williams, and she'd heard Fritjof talking about ecological literacy and systems thinking, and it resonated with her. And she was, at the time, she's a philanthropist and an educator, and she's a member of our board of directors. But she was taking a class from the Rockefeller Foundation in sustainable philanthropy, or philanthropy based on sustainable ideas. And so she had a project that she wanted to do for them, and she wanted to ask and explore how we were going to go about applying this in education. And so we've known her for a very long time, and she's been both a supporter and an influencer. She asked really great questions, and has, you know, really, I think what we said in the end we offered as the dedication in the book, probably something about both her persistence and her insight. She's a remarkably insightful person. So that's the person to whom the book is dedicated.
Okay. Well, we've done our initial groundbreaking overview.
Okay.
And my intention is to dive into the book. Is that
okay,
what you had in mind?
Sure. And I wanted to respond to what you said. You were saying you were concerned about the lack of urgency and the sort of stultified education system that you've seen. Mm. And I want to say that, you know, we too share your sense of urgency. And at the same time, despite the ways in which public education has been stultified by all kinds of pressures that are put on it. In the 20 years that I've been involved in public education, I sort of dived in 20 years ago, I just want to say that we find so many remarkable, gifted, committed educators doing exciting and wonderful and enlivening programs in education. So I feel really inspired by my engagement with them, and some of the stories in the book reflect that 20-year period of working with various people. So there's lots to be really inspired by and positive about that's going on in education, despite all the constrictions and mandates and sort of stultifying pressures that they're at the effect of.
Yes. I meant no offense. I'm a grump. And it's just my nature. So,
right, I'm kind of in the half full department over here.
Okay. There's usually I'm in the habit of organizing my notes, and I looked at them. I have a lot of notes here from the book and from my own and from the feelings and thoughts that it stimulated in me. And I just felt, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to organize them at all. This is dealing with something like our youngsters, our kids, the next generation, the future of life on Earth, and the educational system. I like to look at it as an open system, and I'm willing to jump in anywhere. So
okay.
I guess it wouldn't be it wouldn't be a bad place to start with the five practices.
Okay.
Emotionally and socially engaged eco-literacy is essentially the mantra here.
Mm-hmm.
And should we delineate? Should we give a few words to what? To break it down emotionally, socially, eco-literate.
So I think the way we look at it, or at least it appears in my mental map, is that if you think of each person as concentric circles expanding out, you know, part of education is fostering and cultivating my capacity to be with myself, you know, to be able to, I don't know, in ecological, I mean, emotional intelligence, they talk a lot about managing one's emotions. I don't know, I'm not so much a manager, but, you know, to become fluid with, to become knowledgeable about, to be sensitive to my own self in context, and then to expand that knowledge and that caring to others, you know, in my family, in my neighborhood, in my community. But we're asking people to expand that capacity for empathy or that capacity for caring out to embrace all life, to you know, across the entire planet and out. And so we think of it as a through line, this capacity for caring or for empathy. So it's sort of interesting to think about pairing empathy with understanding how nature sustains life. These are two of the practices that we're advocating as educational practices for becoming eco-literate or for practicing eco-literacy in schools. So there's both an affective dimension of caring, and there's a cognitive dimension of understanding the principles of how nature sustains life. And those are inevitably intertwined.
Yes. Something like empathy, does it need to be taught, or is it not an inherent capacity? Are we not hardwired for empathy?
Well, I think that I think we have this capacity, and I think the younger the person is, the more access we have to it. But we also numb ourselves out. You know, we're between the hectic pace that we are living in and the sort of scheduling that children are subjected to and all kinds of electronic gadgets, and I have a whole collection myself and I love them, but you know, I grew up on a 9,000-acre ranch, and I was, you know, pretty much an unsupervised child who had an unmediated relationship with the natural world. Kids nowadays are pretty much indoors, and you know, they've developed their thumbs and they're you know, they're texting everybody and they're working on computers. So those sort of constraints don't necessarily cultivate our empathic qualities. So I would say that we all have, to some degree or another, I mean, some people are really gifted at being empathic, and yet, I mean, I think this is a universal trait or capacity in humankind, but it can be either thwarted or it can be intentionally cultivated and developed. We think it's critical that that this opening to life be cultivated.
Yes. We had Stephen Kellard on a couple of weeks ago. He said 52 hours a week indoors, 40 minutes a week outdoors for our kids.
Well, and the outdoor experience frequently is either implicitly or explicitly framed with fear and terror and threat. So, you know, just being outdoors, and I mean, this is one of the reasons we just created a little guide to five kinds of gardens for Annie's Naturals. And the first kind of garden that we describe is a seed in a cup in a windowsill. So even nurturing a seed in a cup in a windowsill can cultivate that capacity for nurturing life. So even if I can't go outside, I can experience the mystery and magic of life, and also my role in nurturing life. You know, when I work with kids in gardens, they can hardly wait to get up and run out and see what's happened to their plant. And I think there's so much threat and risk and doomsday stuff that that we numb ourselves also. So I think you know, this what did you say, hardwired, this hardwired ability. But just, I mean, when you think about, listen to that language, hardwired, is borrowing from either a mechanical or electronic model. And so this capacity that we all share is of another nature than a mechanical or electronic phenomenon.
Yes, our inherent nature.
Mm-hmm. But we, you know, we have so little deep experience with nature that we look for other metaphors.
Yes. Yep. Where was your ranch?
Oh, it was my uncle's family's ranch in central Texas, in the middle of nowhere, but sort of literally in the heart of Texas, and you know, full of mesquite and cactus and bobcats and you know, exciting adventures. But you know, when I think of the, you know, I mean, I, so much of what I know was having to, you know, having the opportunity to sort of fend for myself. I mean, there weren't signposts, literally, you know, and if you rode your horse during the day, you had to know, you know, by looking at the sun, how to get back at the end of the day. I suppose the horse knew how to get back, but I'm just saying, skills that were developed in me out of necessity, they're very different from what children are learning today.
That's right. Yeah. Are we burnt out yet on the word sustainability?
Well, you know, again, we have to ask ourselves, what does it evoke in people? And what we're attempting to evoke at the Center for Ecoliteracy is this understanding of living systems. And not everybody has an experience of living systems. So resilience seems to work, because what we're talking about is this capacity for systems to sustain life and the principles involved in that. And so we just keep searching for imagery and language that gets us back to the natural world.
Sustainability synonymous with survivability?
Well, survive puts it, you know, I mean, like, the capacity of nature to sustain life is so thrilling and vast and inexhaustible that survivability has a very different connotation. You know, it's like, if you've got a system really under stress and deeply at risk, and it's barely able to breathe, I think that's more like survivability. Because, you know, a thriving, vivid, highly energized living system isn't struggling to survive. You know, it's the sheer raw vitality of life that we're evoking.
If we can find it.
Well, if we understood how it works better, and we designed our systems to be in harmony with how life is sustained, then we wouldn't keep damming up its inherent energy. And there are ways, of course, to work with living systems, more like Aikido, than to block and minimize and undermine this inherent vitality.
Are adults lost causes, or are they still candidates for public education themselves?
Well, you're talking to the queen of lost causes here. So I don't think we need to, or that it's necessary to write anybody off. I think we're all in that process of discovery, and you know, one of the five practices of eco-literacy is making the invisible visible. Another is that sustainability is really a community practice, and so as we reveal some of the ways in which we're connected to one another, and in fact connected to all life, and we reveal the ways in which when we work together or how we live together, those patterns really equal sustainability. So, you know, we're sort of all in it together, whether we've noticed it or not.
We sure are. Like it or not.
Exactly. I sound like Obama. We're in this together.
Yeah.
Whether that's we're aware of it or we're not aware of it, and to the degree that we can become aware of it. And sometimes that happens through catastrophe. We're looking at what happened in New Orleans. We're looking at what happened in Japan. We're looking at what happened in New York in Sandy. We are looking at what happened in Haiti. And, you know, in an instant, we can suddenly be in it together in ways we did not anticipate. And I think part of what we see is that frequently people do develop a sense of themselves as part of something, as part of a human community and part of something larger, and begin to cooperate. So that capacity for empathy and that capacity for cooperation, I think, are inherent in our human nature. And as we cultivate that capacity in ourselves, then I think we are much more able to realize this collective endeavor that we can call sustainability, that we can call a lot of things, but, you know, that make it work better for everybody.
unintended consequences comes with the territory.
It comes with the territory, yeah. Mm-hmm. Both for better and worse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can hardly take any step. Once you accept that we're all connected, whether we see it or don't see it, and all of life is connected, no matter what we do, there are these inevitable unintended consequences. Many of the things that I would consider the most successful things that the Center for Ecoliteracy has accomplished have been unintended consequences of something else mm-hmm. we set out to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's frequently the way life works. And then I think you kind of retroactively claim some things. But, we are also seeing with all kinds of natural world calamities a lot of unintended consequences at every level of scale.
You write that eco-literate people tend to be more aware that systems exist on various levels of scale.
Correct.
And you talk about nested systems.
Correct.
What are we talking about here?
Well, let's just say something practical, which, that is true from the subatomic to the intergalactic in the way that the living world is organized. But to apply that in schools, since we work in education, you can say that the classroom is nested in the community of the school. And we're talking about the school. I mean, we could talk about the school as an object. We could talk about it as a building, because there's all sorts of exciting things that can be done about schools as buildings. But when we're talking about schools as networks of relationships, there's a network of relationships in each classroom, and then there's a network of relationships in the school community. And then those schools are all nested in the school district. And the school district, of course, is nested in its community. And the school district is nested in the state and all the regulations and mandates and opportunities and funding that come from the state. And all of that's nested in the federal programs and the mandates and expectations of those. And we've, for example, just spent, I think, almost 3 years working very deeply with the Oakland School District. And we tell the story in a story called The Path to Food Justice in the book about our work with Oakland. And, for example, when you start making the invisible visible, one of the things that you notice is that there's a discrepancy in life expectancy between infants who are born in West Oakland and those who are born in the hills who are white. So there's like a 15-year discrepancy in life expectancy, and part of that has to do with food access and the quality of food and environmental factors that contrast these two communities. And so part of our work in Oakland has been to work with the school district to transform its school meal program. And you can't really change school food working one school at a time, or certainly one classroom at a time. So we've worked with the school district that's responsible for feeding almost 8 million meals to kids in Oakland schools. There's 38,000 kids, and many of those kids are eligible for 5 meals a day.
Five meals a day.
Yes, many of those kids are eligible for breakfast,
snack,
mid-morning snack, lunch, afternoon snack, and many of these kids are eligible for a hot supper, because across the country, the number of children whose families have been plummeted into poverty and hunger and homelessness is really intense and immense. And, when people talk about, the 1%, we're really working in Oakland with about 68%, almost 70% of those kids who are eligible for either a free or a reduced lunch, cost lunch in school. So, when you talk about living our nested systems and levels of scale, I think Oakland is a perfect example of this needing to be nimble to work at various levels of scale. We spent a couple of years with them. We did a feasibility study for them to see what it would take to transform their school meal program. It got reviewed by the Board of Education and given a unanimous approval. It got folded into their facilities master plan, and I'm very happy to report as the co-chair of Measure J, which brought a general obligation bond before the voters in Oakland. The voters in Oakland passed the general obligation bond on Election Day by 84%.
It's heartening.
It was heartening. It is heartening. And so now we have to pull it off. But we're going to convert a building that Oakland School District owns into a central kitchen that's going to be able to prepare fresh food purchased from California. We're going to refurbish cooking kitchens across the district and then work with the school district and the community to create school-based community centers, many of which would be co-located where Oakland has based school-based health centers, health clinics. So that's just, you know, from a social science point of view, that's an example of using the principle of living systems, which you see in nature, and applying it, you know, in a social system, in a school district.
Is it accurate to say that the efficacy of public education is hamstrung by poverty and certain levels of social dysfunction?
Well, yeah. One of the reasons we are so interested in emotional and social intelligence is that children's ability to learn is very dramatically impacted by the stress that they're under. And, you know, many kids in urban settings, and many kids in lots of settings, when I look at rural America, they've got, you know, huge social problems there as well. But many kids come to school needing all kinds of help to be in a state of readiness to learn. So, and the worse it gets economically, the more challenged these communities are, and the more at risk children are for not being able to realize their full learning potential.
And it's a great difficulty for the teachers in the classroom and the administrations in the schools.
Yes, for sure. We met last year with a school that someone had decided, I won't tell you where, but someone had decided that this school should be like an environmental magnet. And so we went and met with all kinds of people who were associated with the school. And some of the people who were associated with the school were a religiously affiliated nonprofit. And when they told us about, you know, that a lot of them actually went to the school to bathe the homeless children and to feed the hungry and to find clothing children who did not come clean enough or covered enough or warmly enough dressed. So, we talk about education as if it were separate from the community in which it's embedded. And so in Oakland and in, you know, places across the country, schools are being asked to remedy very dramatic social challenges. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of research that's been conducted on schools that, you know, looking at two variables, threat and challenge. And, you know, if children are in highly threatening circumstances and then have very low challenge, almost no learning can occur. They lose their access to higher order thinking.
Yeah.
So I'm watching all kinds of really inspired, capable teachers doing their best to and not just teachers, but educators. Oakland, I just happen to be a big fan of Oakland and have spent the last couple of years working closely with them. They're doing remarkable things to address these issues. But so schools are simultaneously getting bashed as incompetent, or you name it. You know, it's how we decided to single out teachers as this, you know, this decade's scapegoat is a mystery to me. But I watch educators bending over backwards, doing triple back flips to design really amazing programs to attempt to ameliorate much deeper, wider social problems.
Well, it's just heartbreaking to see any children at all be left behind, so to speak, to suffer the catastrophic circumstances of not being able, through no fault of their own, to be fully present in a receptive and self-esteeming manner of to receive the gifts of public education that are so critical, you know, to the whole life.
Well, one of the stories that Lisa wrote in the book is about New Orleans, and so here's this example of just devastation and how kids in schools who were essentially practicing being a community. They sat in circles. They sustained one another through a very carefully and brilliantly facilitated community practice. And they came up with really exciting, wonderful suggestions for how the school could be reframed and redesigned. Go back to being the half full person, but sometimes out of catastrophe and crises, brilliant, exciting, and very positive kinds of possibilities occur. So we talk a lot about emergence in sustainability and systems thinking. And so, you know, at every opportunity when there's breakdown, there's a possibility of new form and a breakthrough into a new way of being and doing things. And so the pressures under, George Bush and No Child Left Behind and all that crazy stuff that has been mandated, it isn't working. And there are fissures in the breaking down and the breaking through, we're observing all kinds of exciting innovation in education, despite all odds.
The bulk of the book is taken up with eight examples or eight stories about the practice of eco-literacy.
Correct.
And there are two stories each for coal and oil and water and food.
Correct.
And it's I've been hearing lately that ecology is now considered the senior science, where we're coming out of a time when physics was had that kind of title, and now it's being recognized that ecology is where we are most called focus to comprehend at a deeper level, at an increasingly deeper and deeper level, to understand what we're talking about, or what's being indicated that we're in serious trouble, serious grown-up trouble,
right?
And that we need to, and that we're called to a deeper response, or a more mature reality based response. And one of the things that occurred to me in reading the book was, I'm scrambling to find it in my notes to be able to articulate it well, but you refer to school culture, and I'm interested and concerned that we are willing, or that we have the responsibility or the mandate to speak honestly, not only to speak honestly to our children, to not talk down to them, or to not underestimate their intelligence, and to present them as best we can, as tactfully and as sensitively, but as fully as we can, to present them the real difficult reality of our time. And that goes for their families as well, for their parents as well, to not water the message down or sugarcoat it, but to I see it as an act of deep respect to be true to the circumstances that we're facing. This is something that feels very important to me, and possibly controversial. To what degree do we call a spade a spade, and invite our students, our children, to respond with all the gifts that they have for us? And after all, this is their lives, that we have in our own, that we have compromised. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you started by talking about ecology, and to think in terms of ecology is to think in terms of networks and relationships. So this is a great gift, this ecological understanding. And so I think that's the gift we give, is this capacity both to cognitively understand, to have a systems view of life that sees ourselves as part of this infinite web that's intricately interconnected. That's a great gift. And it's also a great gift to evoke this capacity for caring that's expansive. So if we give that gift and we nurture that, then how we deliver the news about the complexity of the problem we're leaving to children, that's different. To just dump on them that we have spent everything, we've used everything up, and that it's over. I mean, it's, in some ways, that's the message that kids are getting, is like, you know, that the end is near, etc. So I think we have to be very careful about what the message is that we're crafting, because
yes,
initiated into ecological understanding, to see ourselves as part of all life and this intricate web of life, that's a great gift, and it allows children to open their hearts and their minds. And with opened hearts and minds, then some of the complexity of the riddles that we're giving them,
mm-hmm,
can be sort of joyfully engaged in. I've been involved in the STRAW Project for a long time, and the Center for Ecoliteracy helped to found Students and Teachers Restoring a Watershed. So, you know, it's very different to take kids out to restore hundreds of miles of creek bed, and then to see that in a very short amount of time, certainly, you know, much less time than we had imagined, to see the restoration of an ecosystem and songbirds returning, etc. That's a very different version of the story than we've used up all the resources. There are unsolvable problems. The end is near, and the great gift we're giving you is a doomsday catastrophe. So I think we have to just, you know, that's why we wrote the book, is there's that engaging and socially, emotionally engaged ecoliteracy is inherently life-affirming. It's energizing. It's exciting. It's fun. It's a calling, which is very different than, here, fix this mess we're leaving you.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. This is a crucial distinction. Does it do any good to consider our situation an emergency, or is there really no need to go there as far as our children are concerned? There's no need to alarm them unnecessarily, even though we are quite alarmed.
Well, I mean, I think between the catastrophe in Japan and the catastrophe in New York, and you know, and everything you see on television, and sort of, I don't know, when you go to the movies, every trailer is sort of an end of the world trailer. I think they're getting the message. The message they're not getting is that you're a part of life. You have all the skills you need. We love you. You know, that that things are possible is not the message they're getting. Mm-hmm. And that things are possible when we work together. And things are possible when we bring our whole selves to working together. That's pretty attractive. So I think we have to be very careful about urgent, catastrophic, you know, I mean, yeah. Is that a package you want delivered to your house?
Well,
you know,
in my case, it's too late. But no, but this is very important. Gee whiz. Something just flew through my head. I want to quote something from the book.
Okay.
You write, although we are well aware of the overwhelming pressures on educators to cover a myriad of topics with limited time and resources, the Center of Ecoliteracy recognizes that the urgency of our global crises compels the education community to rethink curriculum priorities and to infuse a sustainability perspective into the curriculum. Is this proving to be a hard sell?
Well, you know, I just went to some schools in Oakland the other day, and here's the part that is not a hard sell. They are afflicted with what Freud said was our greatest fear. And our greatest fear, according to Freud, is the fear of bits and pieces. So it takes enormous energy to hold isolated, fragmented things. And so anything that can integrate and add meaning can be very much welcomed. So we see this as a way to put together all the disparate parts, all the fragmented this and that, into more integrated wholes. And that is a welcome to educators who can be supported in integrating the various bits and pieces they're expected to teach. And the bits and pieces far exceed the number of curriculum minutes that any teacher has to teach within.
Do you spend any time in the classroom yourself?
I would not last a day in a classroom. This is just one of the things that I love and appreciate so much about teachers. I am way too attention deficit, hyperactive, whatever. I spend, you know who I can relate very closely with is principals and superintendents. But there are people in my organization who really are experienced classroom teachers. So, you know, we talked about levels of scale. There are people in my organization who really understand and resonate with and can empathize with the reality of a day-to-day life of a teacher, hour-to-hour, minute-to-minute life of a teacher. And there are some of us who are have an affinity with and can respond to the daily life of a principal or a superintendent. So, but, you know, there's enough of us who have a real reality test about the true existence of public and private education so that when teachers come and work with us, they feel seen and heard, and the messages that we provide and the recommendations we offer and the resources that we design really work for them.
When I was in school, we used to have field trips.
Right.
Do we take our kids these days? Do we put them in school buses and take them out to the ocean or take them into the forest?
Well, this is just one of the many challenges right now, is that so much money, thank God for the wisdom of California voters who passed Prop 30, because I didn't know what was going to happen if that didn't pass. But, we've spent decades working with schools around school gardens, because frequently kids at least can get out of the classroom and to a little garden or a big garden in close proximity. But, you know, very much like your, I've forgotten who you told me you had interviewed, but who was talking about how the limited number of minutes that children have that are, you know, are indoors. So, the enrichment of experiential, hands-on learning, it's just so critical. And with the constraints in public education funding, very challenging.
Yeah.
But at the same time, let me say, there is a huge movement across the country for urban farming and mm-hmm. school gardens and in places where, you know, it's cold, there are greenhouses and hoop houses and all kinds of clever strategies. So educators seem to be irrepressible in their ingenuity.
Yes, always. Always have been.
Exactly. Maybe that's the primary requirement for signing up.
I always have this fantasy that, women and men who go in for teaching, or for that matter, people who go into any kind of public service, fire or police or mm-hmm. or whatever. I always have this idea that we should, that if they've had the standard training to qualify as professionally competent, that we should just turn them loose. Like if someone has become a biology teacher, we should just turn them loose and let them teach biology rather than hand them a very, very micromanaged curriculum, you know, developed by I spent years in the classroom, years ago, and I remember becoming aware of just how bloated was the bureaucracy, how many very, very well-paid experts with PhDs and middle management, and every speck of the curriculum was massaged and I always felt that teachers were hamstrung, that they weren't set free to follow their hearts, to connect their brains to their hearts and teach with all the passion and devotion that draws them to the profession in the first place. That's just another dream. Just
yeah.
another dream of, you know, of. Of what it's going to be like, you know, when we shake off the reticence to set our own selves free.
Well, poor education, it's sort of like fashion. It seems to just go from one trend to another. When we got into education in the 90s, it was sort of a renaissance in which incredible creativity was taking place. And now in the last decade, it's just been teach to the test and, you know, the one right answer and you know, the imposition of mandates and rules and regulations. And guess what? That isn't working.
Yeah.
So
what a surprise.
Hopefully there will be, an incredible reopening to possibilities.
Yeah. Do you know who Joel Salatin is?
Oh, of course.
Should get him, get him, send him a ticket to Oakland.
Uh-huh.
And let him roam through the schools in Oakland.
Uh-huh.
I think that would be a good idea.
Yeah.
And there are films. There are films about, I just remember being so absolutely delighted when I first discovered Farmer Joel. and his fabulous innovations on the farm.
I know.
You know, it's just.
Well, maybe you should. Maybe you can say it in a nutshell for your listeners. I'm thinking about his roving chicken coop, and is that what you're?
Yeah, fresh salad bar, and
uh-huh.
his chickens. He hooks up the tractor and moves them to a new patch in the field. You know, every day or every 3 days, whatever it is, his integrated,
right.
innovative
right.
management of the farm,
right.
is just. It's more than just efficient and economically sound, but it tickles our sense of delight and it reminds us. That life is a challenge, and that we are most likely very close to infinitely creative,
right?
If given enough,
right, exactly.
You know, the opportunity, and I know that there's that our kids in the classroom. I know how they come alive. For example, when on the first day of school, when they discover that one or more of their teachers is also alive.
Right, exactly.
and that how the opportunity is there for all of us to come alive.
Right, at any moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just 'cause life wants to live.
Yeah.
And I worked with a school once, and we were talking about place-based education, and these were really young children. And so the school decided that the block around the school, because it was a one-block school ground, and then so the block all the way around the school, they decided they would make that part of the school in some kind of way. And so the kids would go to the pet store, and then they would go to the post office, and then they would write letters to the post office thanking them for the tour. And, you know, it just... It was an urban setting, and the chamomile that grew in the crack between the cement blocks suddenly became what those kids got to experience as life. So, we're not able to completely repress life's energy, thank goodness.
Try as we might.
Yeah, exactly. And so learning, despite everything, keeps happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you assess overall the work of John Taylor Gatto?
Well, I I'm sort of on the half full, I think he's on the half empty side of the equation. But he talked a lot about, if I remember, it's been a long time since I've read him, but he was talking about how our systems dumb children down. And so, you know, this capacity, what I was talking earlier about threat and challenge. And so if you have a low challenge, high threat circumstance, you can pretty much have everybody operating significantly below their potential. But if you flip that and make it a low threat, high challenge situation, people rise to the occasion. So I think he was just railing against the degree to which formal schooling can lower and limit children's capacity to learn.
Yeah, he drew a distinction between education and schooling.
Yeah. I know a lot of people don't like schooling. It's sort of a code word for... we wrote a book called Smart by Nature, Schooling for Sustainability, and I got a lot of flack. I just think we can reframe what we mean by schooling and make it education, but I know that there are people who rail against schooling.
Ms. Barlow, many of our listeners have a long time and very deep affection for Dr. Capra.
Yes.
How is Dr. Capra these days?
Oh, Dr. Capra is in rare form. He's having a good time. He's playing tennis, and he just came back from, I think, about a, I've forgotten now, several months in Europe. He has been spending time in Italy and Spain. He spoke last week, taught a class on systems thinking in Seattle, And I'm going to have dinner with him sometime this week. So Dr. Capra is in rare form. He just wrote, I'm not sure if he's finished it yet, but he's come close to finishing a manuscript for a college textbook to be published by a prestigious university in the United Kingdom on the theory of living systems. So, and he looks great, and he's vibrant, and so, you know, I think he's doing extremely well.
Good. Please tell him that our listeners send their love.
Okay, good. Well, and I'm sure that it's reciprocal.
When he was on with us, he was talking about Leonardo.
Yes, he finished his second book on Leonardo. So, I love the Leonardo material.
Would it be accurate to call public education a sacred trust?
Yes, I think that's accurate.
And what I want to invite you is to please speak to our listeners about whatever might be close to your heart these days, about the times we're living in and about what we all might do well to feel into or to understand.
Okay, well, thank you. That's an interesting and evocative invitation. I went on a pilgrimage once in the Himalayas to a sacred cave, and it was about a 5-day climb, and it was like climbing 10 stories a day, and I wanted to go really fast, and the gentleman who was with me, who went with pilgrimages every year, it was in Kashmir in India, and it's what was interesting to me about, or many things are interesting to me about it, but the Muslims were the pony men and the guys who did your tent and kind of took care of you on this Hindu pilgrimage. So anyway, I'm telling you this long story because Mohammed, who accompanied me for this long journey, taught me was to go very slowly. He kept saying, cello, cello, slowly, slowly, because I wanted to go fast. And he taught me to put one foot in front of the other. So I think when I think about this, maybe I'd like to think of it as the issue that we face, the issues that we face, and the urgency that we feel, that the work actually, I think, is to be present in the now and to slowly, slowly put one foot in front of of the other and to stay present to the present moment and to be in relationship to other people and to enjoy the view and, and to know the sacred nature of the journey we're on. And to experience ourselves and the people on the journey with us as sacred also.
Who have you read lately that you would recommend to us?
Oh, I have to admit that I've been reading murder mysteries just to relax my mind. But I wish I could remember the name. In the Vanity Fair this month, there's this incredibly funny, tongue-in-cheek essay on education and parenting that I just thought was magnificent. And, of course, I've been reading night and day as a news junkie, everything I could read on the campaign and the election.
There's a book review in yesterday's Times, a new novel by Barbara Kingsolver.
Oh, what's the name of it?
Flight Behavior.
Oh, wow.
And the review itself by a woman named Dominique Browning, she's a director of something called Moms Clean Air Force. Anyway, the review itself just made me dizzy with pleasure.
Dizzy with Pleasure, that's the name of a book. That's great.
Is that the name of a book?
Or? No, but
yeah.
it should
yeah.
be. That's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. I just bring it to your attention. I bring it to the attention of our listeners.
Well, I love Barbara Kingsolver. I'll be thrilled to read her new book.
Yeah, me too. As if I had spare time.
Well, you know, when there's a good book, you make time somehow.
That's right, of course.
I carry one around, and even if I have, you know, I mean, this is terrible to admit, but sometimes at the red light I read. So, you know, there's time to read a good book.
There always is. And Eco-Literate is a good book. And I want to tell you how much I value you, Half Fullers.
Oh, thank you.
they really keep me in the game.
Well, of course, we're two halves of the same thing.
Yes.
I guess I just need to keep reframing it in a way that gives me that energy. And also, I have like an outrageously sarcastic sense of humor.
Oh.
So I have to keep laughing.
Good. Well, I wish I had known that earlier.
we'll have take two.
Okay.
With the sarcasm path.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to talk to you, and I will give your warm regards to Fritjof, and thank you very much. And I do hope that people will go out and look at, and maybe even purchase the book Eco-Literate.
Yeah. We're very, very fortunate to that you folks are doing the kind of work that you're doing. It's for all of us, and it's just central. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Pleasure to meet you. Bye-bye.
Likewise. Take care.
Uh-huh.
Zenobia Barlow. What a great lady. You never know who you're going to get until you open their microphone. I never heard Ms. Barlow speak before, I don't believe. And one of those bright lights. I know I need them. Thank you. Zenobia Barlow, the Center for Eco-Literacy, one of the co-founders with Fritjof Capra, and I'm sorry, I don't have the other man's name here right in front of me right now. Peter somebody, I believe. Anyway, it's good stuff. And, you know, we might not see them every day or know them, but there's an awful lot of our kids in this world, and they're in school every day, and it makes a huge difference what goes on in every classroom, every hour of every school day. So this is really a very deep devotion for the overwhelming majority of people in the education business. Thank you very much. We're happy to have Alan Lindsley in the studio, getting ready to carry us through the next couple hours of the afternoon. And we'll be back next week. Very, very pleased to tell you that next week we're going to be talking with Colonel Mark Mickleby of the United States Marine Corps, the co-author of an extraordinary essay whose name escapes me at the moment, National Strategic Narrative, I believe it's called. Very excited about that. The great Woody Tash will be with us from Slow Money. And if I can grab this really quickly, Laura Van Dernut Lipsky, a woman who is involved in a field known as trauma stewardship. Very important work as well. Thank you for all our listeners, your support and encouragement. What Now Show, everything's archived at pantedmonkey.org, and we'll see you next week.